and welcome to the latest edition of the RVC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm talking with Dr. Adrian Bosworth of the College's Department of Veterinary Clinical Studies about his research into the area of congestive heart disease and specifically the role of mitral valve disease in dogs, its diagnosis and advances in treatment.
Hey Adrian, thanks very much for joining us. Perhaps you could start off by telling us what congestive heart failure is in dogs or in other species.
Okay, well, congestive heart failure is a state that is brought about when, due to the abnormal function of the heart, the body, in an attempt to restore more normal output, particularly more normal blood pressure in the circulation, the body retains fluid. Mm-hmm. And if the heart disease persists, as they typically do, then what happens is the fluid, more and more fluid is retained within the circulation of individuals who are affected, ultimately to the point where fluid begins to leak out of the normal circulation and forms edema or effusions in either the subcutaneous tissues or in the lungs or in the abdomen or the thorax, for instance. So congestive heart failure is where, as a consequence of a primary cardiac disease, mm-hmm. there is inappropriate retention of fluid leading to edema.
Okay, so I mean, it can be regarded as a sort of endpoint of a number of different diseases.
Indeed, there are lots of different diseases in dogs and cats and other species as well, which will result in the development of heart failure. Classically, in humans, the one which probably happens most frequently is myocardial infarction secondary to coronary artery disease. Whereas in other species, the most common disease differs. And in the case of dogs, the most common disease leading to the development of heart failure is this condition called myxomatous mitral valve disease, where through degeneration of the mitral valve, there is a leak which forms in the mitral valve, which leads to each time the heart contracts, there is some backflow of fluid as well as fluid going in the normal direction out of the circulation. Over time, that progresses, which impairs the efficiency of function of the heart and ultimately results in the development of signs of heart failure.
Mm-hmm. And it's a breed-specific thing as well in dogs, isn't it?
It tends to be. The breeds who are most frequently affected by myxomatous mitral valve disease are small breeds of dog, and so the breed predisposition is very much for dogs, usually under about 20 kilos. Mm-hmm. The sort of archetype in terms of the dogs that get it most frequently is the breed of dog called Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. And they're very widely recognized as developing it at a relatively early age and also typically having a more rapidly progressive form of the disease, whereby they get it earlier and therefore they progress to the point where they've developed signs of heart failure earlier. And they're very much overrepresented in terms of studies of mitral valve disease in dogs.
Okay, but it's certainly something that can occur in other breeds that tend to be on the smaller side.
Indeed, so the other breeds, it affects crossbred dogs quite frequently. Dachshunds, poodles, chihuahuas, those sorts of things. But it can affect almost any dog. But typically dogs below about 20 kilograms. Dogs over 20 kilograms are actually predisposed to a different type of heart disease, which is a disease called dilated cardiomyopathy.
Mm-hmm. So what is it? Is there a particular genetic defect that's been identified in Cavaliers that's causing this? Or
It's strongly suspected that there is a genetic basis to the disease, although it's far from a simple one. What has been shown in some breeding studies that have been done in Scandinavia is that if you look at the parental status at certain ages, then what it can enable you to do is to predict the likelihood of the offspring being affected by the disease. So, for instance, if neither of the parents has a detectable heart murmur by 5 or 6 years of age, then it makes it less likely that the offspring will have a murmur by that age. And so there have been sort of active screening programs to try to decrease the frequency of with which these dogs are affected by the condition, mm-hmm. on the basis that it shows some heritable characteristics, but certainly not in terms of sort of, if you like, simple Mendelian characteristics. You couldn't say this gene causes it.
Right, okay. But there are some efforts underway to try.
There are, yeah, and particularly there are studies looking at can we characterise the difference between those dogs who develop the disease early and have a more rapidly progressive form, and by comparison to those who get the disease late, and some of the more obvious targets as to what might be responsible for the development of the disease are some of the genes encoding connective tissue proteins, particularly because the valve consists a lot of sort of collagen.
How does the disease develop? What's the pathogenesis of the disease? Is it something that comes on very early in life in many Cavaliers?
The earliest sign of mitral valve disease in all breeds, but earlier in Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, is degeneration of the tips of the valve leaflets. And that degeneration, to some extent in older dogs, it may almost be a normal aging change. The prevalence of the disease goes up markedly with age, and you almost can't find a normal valve in a small breed dog that's sort of 12 to 15 years of age.
Sure.
But probably what happens is an accelerated form of the degeneration of the valve in dogs of breeds who are prone to developing it at an earlier stage. So initially what happens is that this degeneration of the tips of the valve leaflets results in failure of normal apposition of the valve leaflets, mm-hmm. and therefore what the mitral valve does physiologically is it prevents the backflow of blood from the left ventricle into the left atrium during ventricular systole. So when the ventricle contracts, the mitral valve closes, and that ensures that all the blood ejected from the left ventricle goes into the aorta. Now, in a situation where there's failure of apposition of the valve leaflets, then each time the ventricle contracts, some of the blood will be ejected back into the left atrium. Now, over time, as the valve continues to degenerate, and also as the heart compensates for the leak, an increase in size of the heart, coupled with a worsening of the competency of the valve, will lead to that leak getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Sure.
So the disease is usually progressive, but typically very gradually progressive, in that there have been some studies that have published sort of average figures for the period of time that it takes for a dog from discovery of its heart murmur to the onset of signs of heart failure. And usually that takes several years, even in the breeds that are perceived to have more rapidly progressive disease.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was going to ask, allude to the situation where one encounters obviously in practice where one could say virtually all Cavaliers that come in have a heart murmur, and I guess, you know, the question is how quickly is that likely to progress? What can you say to the client if it's asymptomatic when you detect it?
That's a fascinating area, and there have been some studies that have been published looking at the period of time for which dogs are asymptomatic, and other studies that have looked at the period of time once symptomatic dogs will survive. So if we take the first case, then one study suggested that for Cavalier King Charles Spaniels who do not have an enlarged heart, so if they had a thoracic radiograph and their heart was not enlarged, mm-hmm. the average period of time that it would take that group of dogs to go into heart failure, so the time at which 50% of them are in heart failure, is somewhere in the region of about 1,200 days.
Right.
So that's between 4 and 5 yeah. years. If they have an enlarged heart, then their median time, so the time to which 50% of them go into heart failure, is maybe around about 900 to 1,000 days. So they are effectively at a more advanced stage of the disease, and they go into heart failure consequently sooner. But once a dog goes into heart failure, even with optimal treatment, the median survival time typically is going to be around about 200 to 300 days, mm-hmm. which means that if you do the calculations, you can see that dogs typically spend at least 75% of the duration of their disease free of clinical signs. And by inference, probably more than 3/4 of all of the dogs that you will see with a heart murmur do not have signs of heart failure. From the point of view of how can we predict which dogs are nearer to the development of heart failure, that's a really difficult topic, but there have been several studies that have looked at which factors are predictive of the onset of heart failure and which factors are ultimately predictive of the likelihood of death. And a separate study that I'm involved in, not the Quest study, but a different study, we've looked at echocardiographic indices and also some circulating biomarkers, as well as how can we use these to predict or to pick out a high risk group that are more likely to go into heart failure soon. And I guess it would be safe to say we've got some promising results from that study, mm-hmm. that we might be able to pick out what would be regarded as an at-risk population. But it is a real challenge on the basis of finding a murmur alone to really prognosticate for that patient.
Okay, and I was going to come on next then to the diagnostic modalities and determining, you know, which of these dogs then are going to be mm-hmm. progressing, or indeed how your sort of current protocol for assessing dogs which are getting into failure. So presumably you still start off with a radiograph and go from there.
I think the two best tests for evaluating dogs with this disease are radiography and echocardiography, and they tell you slightly different things. Mm-hmm. Radiography is a great test for giving you information overall about the size of the heart, and therefore whether, if generally speaking, if a heart disease or if mitral valve disease is significant, then it will cause enlargement of the heart. And to some extent, one could say, although it's not an absolutely linear relationship, you can say the worse the disease, the bigger the heart.
Sure.
So radiography is quite good at that. What radiography is excellent at, and really the only test that can tell you this, is whether or not the animal's going on to develop signs of heart failure. So as we said at the outset, heart failure is characterized by the retention of sufficient fluid to lead to the development of edema. Mm-hmm. And if that heart failure is left-sided heart failure, which is what results from mitral valve disease, then that edema is within the lungs. And the only thing that can demonstrate the presence of pulmonary edema conclusively is a thoracic radiograph.
Sure.
So what thoracic radiography enables you to do is to sort of stage the disease in terms of the degree of cardiomegaly and stage the disease in terms of the presence or absence of heart failure. What radiographs don't enable you to do is they don't enable you to make a definitive diagnosis of mitral valve regurgitation.
Uh-huh.
To demonstrate that the valve is actually leaking, what you require is a technique that enables you to see within the heart, and our best non-invasive technique for doing that currently is echocardiography, and particularly with Doppler echocardiography you can conclusively show evidence of a leak in the heart valve.
Is echocardiography now something that is fairly widely available in practice?
It's quite widely available. But what I would say is not to do down echocardiography, but mitral valve disease is not a difficult disease to strongly suspect.
Sure.
In the absence of echocardiography. This phrase, you know, if it looks like a duck and it quacks, it's probably a duck.
Yeah.
If it's a small breed dog with a left apical systolic murmur, it's probably got mitral valve disease. And so I don't think that lack of access to echocardiography means you can't manage dogs with mitral valve disease effectively. Mm-hmm. I think that often it's a diagnosis that can be made, or at least very strongly suspected, on the basis of a good physical examination in conjunction with a thoracic radiograph. And since radiography is the better monitoring test into monitoring progression of the enlargement of the heart and monitoring for the presence of heart failure, I think you can do a good job by doing a thorough physical examination and radiographing these patients. Ultimately, by comparison to other cardiac diseases that dogs get, mitral valve disease is so common that 75% approximately of all dogs in practice with a heart murmur have mitral valve disease. Which means that if you guessed mitral valve disease every time you saw a dog, you'd be right 75% of the time, which is pretty good going.
Sure, and I guess in practice, in both senses of the word, you're managing the failure, the consequences of the disease, rather
Indeed.
Than tackling the disease per se.
That's right. We would love a treatment which could slow either the rate of deterioration of valvular function, or alternatively could slow the rate at which the heart enlarges or responds to the consequences of that valvular malfunction. But we certainly don't have the former, in that we don't have a treatment which has been shown to affect the rate of deterioration of valvular function. We may have treatments that to some extent can modify the response of the cardiovascular system, but no therapy as yet has been conclusively shown to in any way modify the progression from development of the leak to development of heart failure. And we only really know that we have effective therapy after the onset of heart failure. And that's actually a very frustrating place to be, because sure. we have nothing that will that we think will effectively alter the course of the disease for more than 75% of the duration of that disease. So all that we can really do is deal with signs of heart failure once they develop, rather than prevent them from developing.
Okay, well, we'll go on to currently recommended treatments in a moment, but I just wanted to pick you up on something you mentioned earlier, and I guess this is something that's used a lot more in human medicine, but laboratory indicators of disease. I understand that there's a bit of movement now, and perhaps there may be a blood sample that may be of use.
There's a huge amount of interest in this area at the moment, and we're actively researching this, as are several other groups. I think it would be safe to say there's been a real revolution in terms of the approach to the laboratory diagnosis of heart disease and heart failure in human patients in the last 10 to 15 years. And there are now two markers in humans which are considered effectively to have the best level of evidence to advocate their use. So if you look at the evidential basis behind them, there's a substance called troponin, which is a normal myocardial protein, and it's released into the circulation when myocytes die.
Right.
And that in humans has now been incorporated effectively into the gold standard for the diagnosis of myocardial infarction. So if you're suspected of having a myocardial infarct, they'll take a blood sample, look for evidence of elevation of troponin. And it is such a good test that if your troponin is not elevated, they can effectively rule out a myocardial infarct.
Right.
The other marker, and a marker which is probably of greater use in veterinary patients who don't suffer myocardial infarction with anywhere near the same frequency, is a type of marker called natriuretic peptides. And natriuretic peptides are markers of myocardial stress, where either the stretch of the atrial wall or particularly stretch of the ventricular wall will result in increased production and release of natriuretic peptides into the circulation. And measurement of natriuretic peptides has been shown to be an accurate way of discriminating human patients who are breathless according to whether their breathlessness is due to respiratory disease or cardiac disease.
Okay.
Also, natriuretic peptides have this huge potential, which is being explored to some extent in human patients, for prognostication. So the more elevated your level is, the worse you'll do. And perhaps most excitingly, guiding therapy, in that if your natriuretic peptides are high, they treat you in an effort to bring it down. And if it comes down, then you're more likely to do well in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the veterinary field, we've only recently, and it was first described in the published literature last year, had access to a particular type of assay, which is assaying for a canine-specific molecule, which is called N-terminal pro-BNP. It's effectively a byproduct of BNP production.
Okay.
And measurement of N-terminal pro-BNP has been shown already in three studies to be a pretty accurate way of differentiating respiratory disease from cardiac disease and heart failure from simply heart disease. And we're involved in quite a big study at a couple of clinics in London where we've been monitoring N-terminal pro-BNP concentrations in dogs with mitral valve disease, and they seem to be very predictive of mortality. So they are markers of the extent to which the disease has progressed, and probably also markers of that patient's individual risk. Hopefully we'll have some more work on that published quite soon, but my prediction, clearly predictions can be very wrong, would be that within the next 5 years or so, they will be much more widely adopted and used in the management of veterinary patients. And one of the reasons I think they may be used widely in veterinary patients is that in first opinion veterinary practice, there is more limited access to some of the higher tech tests that are available in human hospitals, like MRI and stress echocardiography and all those kinds of things. The great thing about the blood test is it may be able to provide you with a lot of information and also be extremely accessible.
Okay, so it's presumably then going to have some good usages for management and prognosis anyway, alongside...
Indeed. At the moment, one could say that the proof is clearly there for diagnosis, we think that we have some proof that demonstrates the effect on prognosis, and the, as far as effect of therapy is concerned, that is as yet unexplored, but I think it's a study that's just waiting to be done.
Excellent. Okay, so the next thing I was going to move on to then was to talk about when to initiate treatment. Mm-hmm. So when you've got the murmuring cavalier, if you like, at what stage are you intervening?
This is a controversial area, but as I've already referred to, the real evidence of benefit seems to start if you initiate treatment once animals are clearly showing signs of heart failure. There have been three studies now published which have tried to address the question of whether earlier therapy with ACE inhibitors is beneficial. Mm-hmm. So one study, it was published back in 2002, looking specifically at cavaliers, evaluated whether enalapril would delay the onset of heart failure. And that study, although the first study was the biggest study and probably the best conducted from the point of view of being double-blind, placebo-controlled, all of those things.
Okay.
And that showed no evidence of benefit of administration of enalapril in delaying the onset of signs of heart failure. Now, two subsequent studies, that one of which was blinded but smaller and another one that was smaller and not blinded, have questioned the results of the original trial, but I think neither of them is methodologically better than the original study, and neither of them, to my mind, has produced evidence sufficiently conclusive to say early treatment works.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, as a clinician, one of the things that's very difficult for people to do and to accept, I think, is this sense of the inability to change the course of a disease. So people want to believe that treatment will work, but if you look at the evidence, at the moment it suggests that treatment probably doesn't work. What we do know is that once heart failure has developed, and there have been several studies now that have looked at heart failure on the basis of a thoracic radiograph as an inclusion criterion, so animals are included in the study once they show evidence of heart failure, then we can clearly show that therapy affects outcome. So what I do is I initiate treatment when I think an animal is clearly demonstrating clinical signs as a consequence of their disease. Now, that sounds on the face of it quite straightforward, but actually it is a challenge sometimes in elderly patients, often with comorbid disease, knowing whether or not signs that they are showing are definitely a consequence of cardiac disease. So mild breathlessness or intolerance of exercise or coughing.
Yeah.
And I also make it sound quite straightforward by saying thoracic radiographs help you diagnose pulmonary edema. Actually, the ability to diagnose pulmonary edema on a thoracic radiograph is a specialist skill. Specialists have been shown in some studies to be better at it than non-specialists, and even specialists disagree on some thoracic radiographs whether pulmonary edema is present.
Yes.
So our criterion for starting therapy is not quite as black and white as we would like to think. But basically, for me, it's easy if the animal has no signs. If the murmur is discovered fortuitously, or if the murmur is discovered when the animal's being examined for some other problem, then that, to my mind, that animal doesn't need treatment.
Mm-hmm.
If the owners come in and say, my dog's breathless, my dog's exercise intolerant, my dog's inexplicably losing weight or something like that, a sign that could be attributable to heart disease, then I'll start to think, well, does this animal need therapy? If they're free of signs attributable to the disease, then I don't advocate treatment. And it, no matter how big their heart is, and no matter how advanced apparently their disease is, if they're not showing signs, to my mind, they don't need it.
Okay. So you've already mentioned one or two large-scale trials with enalapril. One that you've been involved with relatively recently was a large-scale trial of a relatively new drug, pimobendan. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more about that. First of all, what sort of drug is that?
Pimobendan is it's a fascinating drug. It's what's called an inodilator, and it has sort of what's called a dual mechanism of action. So the ino bit in the inodilator means that it stands for it being what's called an inotropic drug.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a drug which, inotropic drugs as a class, increase the force of contraction of the heart. And the mechanism, in fact, there are two mechanisms whereby pimobendan does that. One is through enhancing the interaction between calcium and troponin C. Troponin C is a regulatory intracardiac protein. And basically, the more calcium interacts with troponin C, the more vigorously that the heart will contract.
Okay.
The second mechanism, which also has an inotropic effect, is that pimobendan is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. And phosphodiesterase breaks down an intracellular messenger called cyclic AMP. And if you inhibit the rate of breakdown of cyclic AMP, effectively what you do is it's like prolonging the signal from the sympathetic nervous system to the heart to work a bit harder.
Right.
So cyclic AMP is a kind of second or third messenger downstream from sympathetic stimulation. So you increase cyclic AMP, you also increase the interaction between calcium and troponin C, and that increases the force of cardiac contraction. But as well as that, the dilator bit of inodilator is that the phosphodiesterase inhibiting effect within the vasculature leads to vasorelaxation. So your arterial tone is reduced and your vascular resistance is reduced, which makes it easier for the heart to eject blood into the arterial circulation. So you have these dual effects, which is an increased force of contraction plus an increased ease of ejection from the ventricle, which seem to both add up to beneficial effects in cardiac disease.
Okay, so it seems to have a number of different beneficial
effects.
It does. So how did it perform in the Quest trial?
Well, the way that we structured the Quest trial, as any clinical trial should be, is that we compared the performance of pimobendan to the performance of what was at the time when we were designing the protocol, the standard best therapy. And the standard best therapy for heart failure, on the basis of a couple of previous studies, and just to throw out some acronyms, there was a study called the LIVE study and a study called the BENCH study. What they did was they showed that ACE inhibitors plus diuretics in the treatment of heart failure are better than diuretics alone.
Yeah.
So we then, taking that on, we were using diuretics plus ACE inhibitors and comparing to that diuretics plus pimobendan. The way in which it was done, it was a blinded study. We recruited a large group of animals. The Quest study, in terms of a heart failure trial in dogs, I think is currently the biggest study in the literature. We've recruited 260 dogs for various protocol violations. We had to throw out 8. And so we reported the results from 252 dogs. And I think that's the biggest prospective heart failure study in the literature. So it's quite, it's small by comparison to some human studies, but it's fairly big.
Significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And that number, 260, was generated on the basis of an a priori power calculation that we thought that was how many we would need on the basis of our predicted effect.
Mm-hmm.
So those animals were then randomized. So we had randomization, we had blinding. And they were randomized to either receive benazepril, which we chose as a representative of the class of ACE inhibitors, or pimobendan.
Yeah.
And then they were followed to the endpoint. And the endpoint of the study was what we called a composite primary endpoint. So an animal was considered to have reached the endpoint if they did one of several things. And the three things that meant a dog had reached the endpoint was they either died spontaneously of their disease, which unfortunately is an inevitable consequence in many patients with heart failure.
Mm.
They were put to sleep as a consequence of the progression of their disease and the owners feeling that their quality of life was poor.
Sure.
Or, for ethical reasons, we included what we called a treatment failure endpoint in the study, which meant that the animal was getting the medication, whichever one it was in whichever group, plus maximal doses of diuretic, plus other medications that it was allowed to receive, like digoxin potentially as well. And despite that, had refractory signs and a poor quality of life or failure to tolerate that combination of medication. So we had three endpoints, which we think roughly equates to, well, at least in two of them definitely equates to the period of survival. And for the animals that reached the treatment failure endpoint, we felt that they would be very near the end of their disease course.
Sure.
So we feel that that endpoint is representative of survival in our study. So we have a population, we randomize them essentially into two groups to receive one or the other, and then follow them over time and looked at the rate at which they reached the endpoint. And what we showed in the study, the primary conclusion of the study was that the median time to the endpoint in those two populations was very significantly different. So just to explain that a little bit, if you look at how long did it take for 50% of the benazepril dogs to reach the endpoint, well, that took 140 days.
Yeah.
How long did it take for 50% of the pimobendan dogs to reach the endpoint? Well, that took just over 260 days. So we had a difference of, if you look at it in percentage terms, just over 90% prolongation of survival time in the pimobendan dogs by comparison to the benazepril dogs,
mm-hmm.
which added up statistically as being a very significant difference between the two. As well as statistical significance, you need to think about kind of clinical significance. What does it really mean? Well, the difference in period of time between the two groups equates to the average dog living 4 months longer.
Right.
Which is, you know, that's a very meaningful number to tell an owner that if your dog goes onto this treatment, then the chances are, you know, the average dog will live 4 months longer if it's receiving pimobendan compared to the group receiving benazepril.
Okay, and that's quite significant in terms of the length of a dog's life.
It is. I mean, as I say, it's an additional 90% on the basis of our numbers of the median time. Now, several kind of subsidiary conclusions, if you like, which we looked at and I think we can draw. One of the things with a composite primary endpoint was, is it that we're having an overwhelming effect in one of the endpoints and not actually affecting the time to the other two endpoints? And so by putting all three together, are we somehow hiding something? We sub-analysed the median time to each of the endpoints for the dogs that reached that endpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And although, because it's a sub-analysis, it didn't reach statistical significance, what we did show was that for every one of the three endpoints, the pimobendan group's median was longer than the benazepril group's median. So it wasn't that we were having an overwhelming effect in one group and drowning out the other effects.
Yeah.
It was an effect across the board. The other statement to make is that because we've shown that pimobendan performs better than an ACE inhibitor, what we haven't shown, it's not effectively the same as drawing the conclusion that either ACE inhibitors are bad or that ACE inhibitors are no longer required.
Mm.
Because what we didn't have, and intentionally, because from the point of view of statistical power, you want to reduce the numbers of groups in your study, but what we didn't have was a group that received both. So what we don't know is whether there would be additional benefit of a dog actually receiving pimobendan plus an ACE inhibitor.
Yes.
And that's an unanswered question currently.
Okay, so was this just in Cavaliers or in various breeds?
No, it was in various breeds.
Yeah.
And what we found out, and not unexpectedly, was that about a third of all the dogs in the study were Cavaliers.
Yeah.
And that's probably representative of kind of both the popularity of Cavaliers as a breed and the frequency with which they get the disease. So they were the single most well-presented breed within the whole study.
Right.
And that actually enabled us to do some sub-analyses within the study and see whether the Cavaliers behaved any differently to other breeds.
Okay, so I guess the final question really then is, I mean, that's obviously very good evidence for an effect of pimobendan. So what are your current guidelines then for treatment of heart failure secondary to mitral valve disease? I mean, what combinations are you advocating at which times?
There's a lot that goes into designing an individual treatment protocol for any given animal. And if you like, what we can talk about is kind of the Rolls-Royce protocol, which would be the protocol that for which we believe there may be an indication for use of all of the agents. But also we have to say we have to have practical protocols that can be given by real people to real animals. Now, the way I would look at it now is that the results of the Quest study have changed, if you like, my prioritization of medications. That if an animal is in congestive heart failure, the one thing which I think everyone would agree on is that the drug which is most required is a diuretic.
Mm.
So if a dog's in congestive heart failure, it needs a diuretic, and the most widely used, for good reason, diuretic is furosemide. So basically, if they're in failure, they get furosemide.
Sure.
What the Quest study has done is changed what I would recommend as the second drug that should be introduced. And the second drug that should be introduced now, I would argue, is pimobendan on the basis of the Quest results.
Yeah.
The third drug now would be an ACE inhibitor, and there's probably a candidate for a fourth drug too, and that would be spironolactone.
Right.
Now, what's going to make me choose a one-drug protocol over a two-drug protocol over a three-drug protocol, say? Some issues like cost, owner compliance, those kinds of things. But if cost is not an issue, and if the owner feels that they're happy to administer at least three medications a day, then typically I would go straight in with the three-drug protocol and use furosemide plus pimobendan plus an ACE inhibitor. And there is some evidence at the moment that's emerging to suggest that in that situation, even spironolactone may have an additional benefit. So if the owner really wants to go for the Rolls-Royce, we may put them on as many as four.
Right.
There is such a step up in benefit between giving just furosemide alone and giving furosemide plus pimobendan, that, if you like, my minimum protocol would be furosemide plus pimobendan, but a lot of dogs would end up on more than that.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed for that really insightful look at the latest developments into diagnosis and treatment of congestive heart failure and mitral valve disease, a problem I guess most of us are all too familiar with from general practice.
Pleasure.
And thank you all very much once again for listening to this latest edition of the podcast. As ever, if you have any comments or suggestions about the podcast, feel free to write to us at podcast@rvc.ac.uk. And I hope very much you'll be able to join us again next time.